PPI.org.
Greetings, and thank you for joining Disability and Progress, where we bring you insights into, ideas about, and discussions on disability topics. My name is Sam. I'm the host of this show. Thanks so much for tuning in. I want to also remind everyone, if you want to join my email list, you can email me at disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com, and we will stick you on that, and you'll find out what's coming up each and every week. And this week, as soon as I shut my speech off, we are speaking with Dr. Mona Mankara. Dr. Mankara is an assistant professor in the Department of Bioengineering at Northeastern, where she heads a combined computational modeling of biointerface engineering lab. And Dr. Mankara believes that vision is more than sight. Good evening, Dr. Mankara.
Yes, good evening. Thank you for having me.
So what do you prefer to be called here?
Oh, you just call me Mona.
Okay, excellent. I know. It's so funny making that sounding like that. I want to start out by asking you what that tagline means to you, that vision is more than sight.
You know, a lot of times, you know, we refer to vision to the actual just process of seeing an object. But in my opinion, when we also refer to vision, it is the idea of thinking ahead, mm-hmm. thinking bigger, strategizing, you know, to be a visionary is somebody who is there to try to impact the world uh-huh. in a positive and unique way. And so vision is more than the literal aspect of seeing. You don't need to see with your eyes to have vision, in my personal opinion. So
excellent.
Yeah, that's what I mean by that.
Thank you. I want you to, now that we've gotten all started and gotten our feet wet, can you please kind of give me a little bit of a history about yourself? You are blind and kind of where you grew up and how you lost your vision.
Yeah, sure. So I was born in Maryland, but I grew up in Boston, so I consider myself Bostonian. I was diagnosed with macular degeneration of corneal dystrophy when I was 7, and I lost, I would say, the majority of my eyesight, like 95% of it, in the next year or so. I grew up, you know, in the public school system. I currently have, like, maybe only like light perception. You know, I'm blind. I cannot read text. That's a very important distinction. You know, there's a spectrum of blindness. Mm-hmm. And ever since I was a child, I wanted to be a scientist. And I'm happy to say I am one. I get to express that and run a research lab. I use computational techniques to study molecules at the air liquid interface in the lungs. So, yeah.
So what kind of struggles did you feel you had growing up as far as visually?
I think the biggest struggle is actually interfacing with society and society's expectation of what a blind person can or cannot do. You know, I tell people this story very often. I'm going to tell a short anecdote and, you know, tie it into kind of my story. In the 1960s, there was a researcher, a clinical psychologist, who ran an experiment. His name was Bob Rosenthal. He brought in a bunch of average rats and in the middle of the night crept into his lab and labeled half of them as intelligent and half of them as dumb. And then he told his experimentalist the next day to help the rats through a maze. And over 2 weeks, they did that. And amazingly, the rats that were labeled intelligent ended up going through the maze twice as fast as the rats that were labeled dumb, even though they were all average rats. And so it all came down to, what do these experimentalists expect of the rats?
Mm.
And that's kind of, and that's a really important lesson, and it, you know, manifests in behavior, right? And so
right.
his theory was they were gentler to the intelligent rats or whatever. And I kind of experienced that myself, in the sense of, before I was seven, you know, I always wanted to be a scientist. I was inspired to do science.
Mm-hmm.
And when I turned seven and I was diagnosed,
mm-hmm.
everything changed. Teachers said, oh, well, now it's not practical, or, you know, like, let's lower the expectation. Let's put her in lower classes. But really, all that changed was that my eyes didn't work, but my brain still worked. So I really faced that struggle of having very low expectations of me, actually.
What were your family's expectations?
I have to give my parents credit. They just were like, whatever you want to do, you do, you know? And that was a really important philosophy that at home I got to pursue. Like, you know, their expectations were still like, no, this is not going to stop you.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't necessarily the case in the classroom.
Yes. And you were integrated. So, I mean, you were in public schools. So what did you feel like, how did that affect you? Did they see you as just another peer, or was it, did they treat you as always different?
So I was put in lower level classes for the majority of my education until I was in high school, when in 10th grade, I was like, I'm so bored, I want to take advanced biology. And I went to the head of the science department, and he was just like, no, Mona, you're going to fail. And then I was like, I don't care. Like, I have the right to take this class. It's a public school. Like, my parents pay taxes. And I went to my biology teacher.
Where were you when I was in high school?
Yeah. I was like, I got to a point in which I was just like, I'm so bored, I'd rather fail than do this again, you know?
Uh-huh.
I went to first day of biology class, and the teacher was like, you don't belong here, you're gonna fail. And I was like, I don't care. And she was like, well, I'm not gonna change the way I teach. I ended up actually getting one of the highest grades in the class. She apologized, and my perception of myself changed also.
And
so that was a huge turning point for me.
That is a huge turning point. And you talk about always wanting to be a scientist, but when did you really discover that you wanted to be in, and how did that happen, do you think? What struck that chord in you?
Honestly, I feel like it's a very incremental process. Like, when I was a child, I watched PBS, and I watched Bill Nye the Science Guy, and I watched Magic
School
Bus.
I love Bill Nye.
I know. Bill Nye the Science Guy. Anyways, Bill. And so I was just curious about how the world works. And mm-hmm. that stayed with me. I remember learning about Marie Curie. I just always loved science classes. And when I went off to college, I love everything. And I ended up changing my major a bunch of times, but I landed on Middle Eastern studies and chemistry. And it was like almost 50-50, but then I was like, chemistry like intrigues me more. I remember like taking physical chem and learning quantum, and I was like, this is it, like, this is amazing. And that solidified kind of the adult path of being a scientist, right? Like, my dream was always to be a scientist. I didn't know how I was going to do it. I didn't know exactly what I was going to do,
mm-hmm.
but I wanted to learn more about the world.
Mona, I just think it's funny because probably, you know, there, science is, heavy science even, doesn't really have a ton of women. There's plenty of women in it now, but it used to not be like that. But for the blind community, that is even like less so. So
yeah, I feel like I'm a unicorn sometimes.
Yeah, I love unicorns. So what? I mean, how many people are in your field? blind
that
people
are blind
was.
And female?
Yes.
I haven't come across any. So if any of you are out there listening, please reach out to me.
It's so great because you are just like the smartest person I know.
You're too kind.
So probably most people have no idea what bioengineering is, really. And can you kind of enlighten us?
Sure. I mean, honestly, I feel like sometimes I don't even know. No, I shouldn't say that out loud. Okay, bioengineering spans anything that involves engineering and biology. So it can span anything from like, getting a mechanical, like a knee transplant, like the device for your knee, or like a pacemaker, everything from that to what I do, which I basically look at studying proteins on the atomic scale, all the way ranging to, it's just like anything biology related, and you must engineer. So I'm trying to think, like that's all I got for you. It's a really wide area. So my specific degree was in chemistry. Mm-hmm. I just now apply chemistry to bioengineering.
Gotcha. So what kind of struggles do you find in your field of chemistry here?
Well, honestly, the entire field is designed to be visual, and I'm blind. Everything is visual. I mean, unfortunately, we've also taught the modern scientists that observable is only through the eye, and that's not true, but... So I have to sit down and problem solve to how do I visualize this protein? So I do everything from literally have people trace structures with a hot glue gun, wait until it dries and it's like 3D, mm-hmm. to using Play-Doh, to using molecular modeling kits, using my screen reader, all the digital text out there, all the journal articles are not accessible. I mean, there's a lot of struggles. And so there's a lot of things that we can do to change that so that we can allow more blind people to be scientists if that's what they want.
Why are the journal articles not accessible? What do you mean by that?
Literally, I can't even use a screen reader to listen to them, to navigate through them. And they're not is because nobody's asked for them to be, even though it's not that hard. You just need to make sure that whatever you're producing digitally is accessible. So we need to definitely, as a community, work towards that. You might be sitting there wondering, why should a blind person even be a scientist? And my response is because the more people you have with different opinions, like different perspectives, the more likely you're going to be able to solve future problems.
Excellent.
And that's what science needs.
Yes, yes. And a more, I think, evenness. I mean, there's plenty of very extremely bright females out there. So why not, right?
Oh, 100%. 100%. But, unfortunately, there's still a class of people who's like, well, you're blind. Like, why try so hard? Like, why even bother, you know? And my answer to them is, this is who I am. And all I want in my life is to get to be and to do what I love doing.
So
and to contribute.
Talk a little bit about combined lab research. What does that mean?
So combined lab stands for computational modeling for biointerface engineering. And so, we have graduate students, undergrads. And what we do is we literally model. So we observe kind of the atoms and molecules that are in your lungs. So as you're sitting here today listening to the radio, you're breathing, hopefully. If you're not, please get that checked out. But we're all breathing. And as we breathe in and out, our lungs are expanding and contracting. And all these molecules are like basically moving and freaking out, right? There's just like constantly moving and a lot of action is happening inside your lungs right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I do is try to understand what is that action and try to help connect that back to diseases. There's a lot of lung diseases that are related to how those molecules are moving. and trying to understand that could really help with like fighting disease. So when COVID became a thing, this is a big deal. I mean, you know, with the pandemic, you know, we studied how COVID was interacting.
Wow.
So things like that. So that's what I do.
So you have a really good idea of how COVID does what it does, as much as a lot
of other people. To a degree. Like, we have, like, at least what we can do is tell you what COVID interacts with, like, in the lung. And then, you know, after that is, like, somebody else's bioengineering problem.
I'm curious. You did a kit that you made up with. Can you talk about the kit? I don't want to give anything.
Yes, okay. Yes. Okay, so one of the things that I like using is molecular modeling kits. So that's just literally, like, spheres that you connect and you can build a molecule. Well, unfortunately, all molecular modeling kits right now that are in the market are not accessible to blind people. Every atom has a different color, but they all feel the same. So what we did is basically add texture to those molecules. And hopefully in the next few, like, you know, we're working on it, but we're working on trying to make that publicly available for people to be able to buy. And hopefully I would love for that to actually take over, you know, the existing molecular modeling kit, because that's more accessible.
So, like, you'll know what a hydrogen looks like, or...
Exactly. Or you'll know which one is the hydrogen, which one's the oxygen, just by feeling it.
And how many are in the kit?
I mean, we haven't finalized those numbers.
Gotcha.
But, like, you know, there's around 50 pieces so far.
So this could be really great for schools. You know, I think 100%. A lot of times kids get that cannot see or have a hard time seeing get really quite left out of, you know, all the chemistry and things like that. And they probably try to understand, but, you know I got left out. So,
oh, I totally got left out too. And these are basically things I wish I had as a child. I mean, how cool is it to get to develop and create things that would have helped me in my education and still help me today as a grown adult scientist?
Yeah. You did another interesting thing. Well, you've done a lot of interesting things, but one of the things that you have worked on in the past couple years, and actually you were doing this during COVID time too, I think, was something called Planes, Trains, and Canes.
I do have to say, we did do it right before COVID.
Right before,
timing
okay.
was impeccable.
Because it was really tight there. I was like...
It was. I mean, I didn't know. I mean, nobody knew, right? Like, okay, so let me tell you. Planes, Trains, and Canes is an awesome project that I got to do. So back in 2018, I think I applied early 2019. I was stressed out applying for jobs to become a professor. And I was like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to apply to the Holman Prize, which is a prize given to ambitious blind people by the Lighthouse of the Blind in San Francisco. So anybody listening, feel free to apply. They give you $25,000 for any ambitious idea. So what I proposed is, let me show you how a blind person would travel independently to 5 different cities around the world. Not just travel, but travel using only public transportation and see what happens. And that's exactly what I ended up doing. So there is a YouTube series. You can check it out. Planes, Trains, and Canes, where I go to Johannesburg, London, Istanbul, Singapore, and Tokyo, get into some shenanigans and, you know, ride the public transportation and explore those cities.
So how did you decide which cities you wanted to target?
I wanted a diversity of experiences. So some of it was based on what I've heard. Some of it was based on past experience that I wanted to see if I can capture on camera. And some of it was based on because I saw a hotel on a like a Netflix like documentary series. And I was like, I want to experience this hotel. But yeah, so that's like, it was all over the place. on the reason why.
So what, I mean, these are pretty diverse places. Obviously, the interaction with people with disabilities is going to be quite different. Do you want to talk about some of that?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, it was very different. So, for example, in Tokyo, things were so accessible. Public transportation was really designed with a lot of people in mind, including blind people.
Yeah, Tokyo's pretty amazing.
And that was phenomenal.
Yeah.
On the other hand, in London, you know, there's more of a custodial philosophy. Like, I had to argue to be able to ride the train on my own. You know, I got into an argument. You could definitely check it out. To Istanbul, where I didn't speak the language, but clearly people tried to help when I asked, and people left me alone when I didn't want the help. So it was kind of a whole spectrum of experience. And definitely check it out to see the more nuances that you get to, you know, that you feel when you go to those different cities.
Obviously, these cities were okay with, in some sense, with women traveling by themselves, let alone blind women. I mean, you had a little bit of difficulty in London, but there are countries where now we're struggling with, you know, you can struggle with. You'd never go travel by yourself as a blind woman.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Johannesburg, like a lot of people would like worry about Johannesburg, but like I never felt unsafe. So yeah, I mean, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know.
Did people seem surprised?
I haven't had that experience yet.
Did you feel like people were surprised that you were out there traveling?
In Johannesburg?
Yeah.
I did feel like people in Johannesburg kind of, like some people knew what the cane was, some people didn't. I feel like they pretty much left me alone until I tried to ask for help, and then they were helpful.
Hmm. And what response did you get to doing this type of, you know, YouTube and this project?
Ooh, it was really cool. It caused a lot of discussion, especially the episode in London, which is exactly what I want. I want people to like watch it and think. I got people telling me, wow, Mona, like I never thought about this before. And I got, you know, people insulting me, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Especially in London, they're like, Mona, you should just accept the help. And why are you making a fuss? So the story in London is basically like they were forcing me to accept the help, and all I wanted to know is where the train was, and I respectfully was declining the help. It's good that there are systems to help, but it's better to be heard, right? So sometimes mm-hmm. you want the help, sometimes you don't. And, you know, it just really caused a lot of discussion.
And how did you video all this? Like, what was your setup?
So my setup was I had Natalie Guzzi, who is my camera woman. And the deal was, because I really wanted to experience this as independently as possible,
mm-hmm.
was that she followed me. And I didn't know where she was. When I was on camera, when I was navigating, I was truly like in my element, almost as if I was alone. I knew that Natalie was somewhere in the back. I trusted that she was following me, mm-hmm. but I had no way to communicate with her. I just had to trust that she was following me. What was really cool is also Natalie didn't really question my directions. Like, she never looked up where to go. Like, she was truly there to follow me. So it was me figuring out where to go, me going, me whatever, like doing all those pieces. And Natalie was just trusting me. And that was kind of a phenomenal also experience by itself. And I was trusting her to capture me.
Did you ever get seriously lost?
I don't think I was. What?
Did you ever get seriously lost?
I mean, what is seriously lost? I totally got lost. Well, I totally got lost multiple times.
Yeah, but like a long way from where you... Did you ever have the feeling of, oh my gosh, what have I gotten myself into?
You know what? I kind of allowed myself... Like, I gave myself a pep talk before I started. I was like, Mona... It's okay to get lost. It's part of the adventure. Give yourself time. Mm-hmm. And when I did that, like that, really freed me. There was like weird mental freedom. I was willing to even get like miss a connection just for the sake of me trying.
Is there anything you wish you would have done differently or would like to go back and do it again and do different things?
I definitely learned some things to enhance. I feel like I kind of squeezed a lot of travel. I did most of it in 2 weeks in December of 2019, right before the pandemic. So it was very exhausting. I think I would do that differently.
Any thoughts of doing a second one?
It's not easy to do it. Like, it's not like, you know, it's definitely a challenge.
Any thoughts of doing a second one?
What?
Any thoughts of doing a second one?
Yeah. It's still kind of like not public news, but yeah.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
It's okay. But like, you know, we might be able to do season two. I'll leave it that way.
Okay. Excellent. Mona, what is the Allied Project?
Oh, thank you for asking. So the Allied Project is a project we launched here at Northeastern. It stands for Allies Leading Learning Inclusion Education of Disabilities. And it is what it sounds like, which means that we sit down and talk about issues related to disabilities and how we include people with disabilities, especially in the education realm, and, you know, ask people to become allies and talk about the issues we deal with.
And what are some of the issues you find that you're dealing with?
Well, you know, it was really interesting. We covered that, like, we had different programs related to different disabilities. I think one of the biggest kind of underlying theme is that, number one, people don't know, but number two is that, like, you know, truly starting to bring the discussion to the forefront. Like, a lot of times people discuss, like, diversity, but then, like, they forget to mention disability as part of that. And it's an important part of diversity.
That is an interesting thing, isn't it?
Yes.
And so how do we change that?
Well, I mean, definitely check out Allied Programming, but like, I mean, you know, start asking the questions. I think that's how we change anything. And let's start talking about it like we're doing right now.
Do you think that people with disabilities just don't speak up enough? Or
no,
I mean, there's something.
I think sometimes we're tired of speaking up.
Yes.
But it's like, when we speak, like, please listen.
There is some disconnect there, isn't there? I mean, there is. You see it in all facets, I think, of life. And the whole discussion now is even like with racism. But disability often even sometimes gets left out of that.
Totally.
You know what I mean? There isn't any separation, really. There is no race that lacks disability, unfortunately. There really isn't. And so to leave it out means that you're not covering the whole thing, in my opinion.
Oh, totally. And it's a form of diversity. Like, you know, I mean, we have different needs, but like, I mean, but it really isn't that way. We shouldn't think about it that way. We should think about how we come as human beings to the table and we want to sit at the table. So make room for us so that we can contribute, because we have as a community a lot to contribute.
And so is this project, is it just primarily people who are at your particular college, or is this a nationwide thing that you're trying to do, or how does it work?
Well, so the programming is happening at Northeastern. We do invite people from all over. We do post all the programs online. So there is a YouTube channel called Allied, and you can watch all of our videos there, which is great. Everything is closed captioned and fully accessible. And so you can sit there and learn about different topics. Like, I learned a lot. Like, I learned a lot about the deaf community this past semester, for example. Mm. And the struggle, you know, and the issues and struggles they deal with.
And do you have different disabilities that kind of just take turns discussing what their struggles are?
Yeah, and like different topics. Like, yeah, we had mental health, you know, issues being discussed, neurodivergent, like mobility disabilities, like invisible disability. We had a lot of different topics that we were discussing, including blindness too.
Right. So I am a teacher of technology and Braille for people who are visually impaired and blind, but you're actually a blind professor, assistant professor that teaches just everyone who walks in, you know, who happens to take your class or classes. What is that like teaching for, you know, the general public like that? They don't necessarily have a disability, or they could.
Yes. One of the things is I look forward to the day in which I teach a blind student, actually. I haven't had that yet. and so they've all been sighted. I have had students with different types of disabilities. I'm very excited to accommodate. I want everybody to learn in my class. This is very important to me because sometimes I had professors that didn't care, but I care. I feel like it's a privilege to be able to teach and to have a classroom that you get to conduct and the ideals that you hope to see in the world.
So what is it like for you, though, as a professor? Do you struggle with, is there inaccessibility with materials?
Oh, yeah.
What do you have to do? Like, what are some of the things that you have to work with?
So, yeah, that's a good question. So the first time I ever taught, I didn't know how I was going to do it. It's a biomolecular dynamics and control class. And what that means is a chemical kinetics class. And what that means is very, very visual. And I was like, how do I teach my students when I can't see the board? I can't write on the board. You know, I can't see the projector. What do I do? And so I came up with a system, actually. And yes, a lot of it is dependent on memorization, but I came up with a way to present the notes to them, and then they can copy down the notes and I can talk them through the material. And I actually published a paper about that, that you can read. And it really helped make things more accessible to students, I think. But I had to devise that. It was not an easy process.
And what was, like, you must have used some helping hands to help get things kind of in control and in going there. What was that like?
I use access assistants or people all the time in my work.
And is it easy for colleges to be willing to sponsor or to pay for them to do that for people with disabilities? Because you're probably not the only one who uses those.
You bring up...
Is that a touchy question?
Is it easy? It should be easy. Let's put it that way. I'm lucky in my college, you know, my university provides it. It was something that I actually was very clear about it before I was even hired, that this is what I needed. But I would argue that it's not easy in a lot of institutions, and that needs to change.
And I would think that that could harbor some secret, you know, discrimination, where people maybe wouldn't bring people who might need that in.
Oh, yeah. When I was applying to become a professor, I was totally discriminated against openly. I was told by an individual I couldn't do the job. I was told by an institution that you're great, but we can't hire someone like you because we can't support you, which is totally against ADA. But I was like, okay. Like, you know, you have to pick your battles, because I know I wanted to be at an institution that could support me, and I didn't want to fight through. And I ended up here at Northeastern, and I'm really happy. This is where I wanted to live anyway, in Boston, to go back.
Yeah, you did kind of get your dream job, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
I remember discussing this with you, and you, this is where you wanted to be. And I was like, yeah, but the weather, but this is where I want to be.
I mean, Minnesota, so for everybody out there.
Well, that's true.
Sam, while I lived in Minnesota, and the weather there is worse.
Well, I guess that's true. But so what was it like for you to land your dream job? I mean, most people don't get that.
I mean, I love it. I'm very happy and I'm very lucky. It doesn't mean it's always rainbows and sunshine. No, there's struggles. There's things that come up. You still have to, you know, the system. I'm different for the system. I'm so outside the box. You know, there's a lot of discussions and the conversations around that. But at the end of the day, I'm definitely happy. And I'm getting to contribute to society. And I am teaching students when I was a child and first diagnosed, there's a doctor who told my mom it wasn't worth spending a penny on my education.
Oh.
So I am happy to be able to be teaching students. And how ironic to that doctor. I wish I can find him. I mean, he might be dead now, but and be like, really? Look at the impact that I'm getting to do now.
Are you involved in doing anything with like a blind STEM curriculum?
Oh yeah, I helped design. You read through my entire website, Sam. I helped design. I actually designed a blind STEM curriculum, which is a curriculum that's low cost, it's accessible, and it was designed for a camp of 2 weeks for blind students to be able to run their own experiments from A to Z on their own without using any eyesight.
So STEM, science, technology,
education and math.
Okay.
I mean, engineering and math, sorry.
Engineering and math. So it's a 2 week thing? Tell me about how this works.
The curriculum was for 2 weeks, yeah.
Okay. So how does this work? What happens there? Is it meant for a camp?
I don't want to give away all the details, but basically the students get to experience everything from extracting DNA from a strawberry on their own to making, you know, fizzy lemonade to growing a rat. Like, you know, it's the age group was like 6 to 26, but it was really like 6, you know, through high school, like 6 years old. Yeah, it's high school age. And, you know, engineering concept, exothermic, endothermic reactions, so you can feel them, you know, just like experiments that you might find kids to get to do, but now it's like really encouraging them to do it without their eyesight at all.
It's very hands-on, so to speak.
Yes, they have to. It's really important for a student to do their own project.
So how long has this been out?
Well, it's still under, like, I'm still trying to get it copyrighted. So I wouldn't say it's really out, but like, if you're interested, for anybody interested out there, feel free to email me. Okay. And we can figure something out.
Yeah, you need to get that copyright. Because that's a big thing, you know. Let's see, what else should we, what was the next thing you wanted to talk about? there's so much. I'm not sure which I should tackle. Do you developing more accessible scientific educational tools? If there were things that, I mean, is there things that you feel that you really would love to develop that are not there yet?
Oh, 100%. Like, we kind of touched on that with the tactile molecular modeling kit. There's so much. Like, I can't even begin to start enumerating them right now.
So, any idea for, like, getting a nonprofit or something to do all these, help you with all these projects?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we're keeping it under wraps right now. So, we'll see what I can come up with. But, yeah. Which maybe thinking of creating actually a business just to make it sustainable where we sell some of these scientific tools. But I don't have anything concrete yet, but it's coming soon.
All right. This will be a part two here. So yes, what's the hardest part of being a professor for you?
Sorry. I think the hardest part is just the real lack of access to information. Like, everybody else gets to be able to go online and like sift through really quickly, like thousands of abstracts or journal articles and read through them. And I can't.
What's the most gratifying?
The impact, the teaching the students, the research. You know, when I submitted my first paper as the PI, as the principal investigator, I mean, that was amazing that I'm getting to contribute to the world as a scientist.
How many classes do you teach?
It's just one. It's just biomolecular dynamics and control, like multiple sections of it, but yeah.
So teaching something like that, which is pretty heavy anyway, your students must get quite a reaction from your students. What's generally their reaction to you?
They totally react to me. Well, now I've built a reputation that like I'm a great teacher, so thank you, students. But when I first started, people didn't know who I was, and I actually ran a survey that was anonymous, and I got some really interesting results. So some students were really worried about having a blind teacher. Some students were like, found it as a unique adventure. Some students took it because they thought that I would be more accommodating. And one student told me that his parents were mad to find out that I was blind.
Really?
Which I'm glad I didn't know until the end.
And why? Because they felt their student wouldn't get.
Yeah, they felt like their student would be jipped on their tuition, like for not getting a good professor. And then this particular student said that I was one of the best professors he's ever had.
Wow. So.
But that's what his parents said.
Yeah, it is an interesting thing, isn't it? It's just when you're in a subject that is much more rare for someone with a disability to be in, any disability, the response can be very enlightening, I think.
Oh, yeah. I published all those results, too, in that paper. But now the students are just expecting something now. They're like, oh, it's going to be great. You're going to be accommodating.
And I often found when I was growing up and doing something that not little to no blind people had done, or very few, that there was this, you know, always the doubt, where it sure makes you have to kind of pull into your own and feel like you better make it. You better not, you know, flop on this one because everyone's watching. And that's what I think is so hard sometimes, is that you're so watched.
It feels like the world is waiting to see what I end up doing.
And often held to a higher bar than maybe just the normal professor.
Or just like waiting to see you almost fail. Now, I have to say that I have really great colleagues and I'm really happy about that. And I've learned to really ignore that observation. But yeah, the students, like when they first took my class, they were waiting to see what would happen. Like, it was, like, different than if they just took somebody else's class. You know, they were extra attentive to see what would happen because I'm blind.
So, anything coming up that's exciting in the horizon that you can talk about?
Should we mention Mission Astro Access?
Can you? Are you allowed to?
Yes.
Then do it.
Yes, for everybody. Okay, Mission Astro Access. I mean, it's public news that I got to do this. So another project that I got to do was this zero gravity flight, where we're trying to make space travel accessible to people with disabilities, and actually have people with disabilities contribute to the volume of space travel and, like, you know, and be contributors. So what happened is last October, a group called Mission Astro Access, led by Anna Volker and George Whiteside, basically organized the first ever historic zero gravity flight that had everybody on there, like, who flew was with a disability. And I was one of those people, and I got to experience zero gravity, and it was one of the coolest things I got to do. And then I got invited twice, and now they're opening it up for another flight. So anybody out there who's listening who has a disability and wants to experience zero gravity, definitely check out Mission Astro Access and apply.
So you, what kind of disabilities did you find people had?
They did blind, deaf, and mobility.
And the object was to what?
To observe and to run experiments, like how does a blind person navigate, for example, in zero gravity and find their way back? How does a deaf person sign, and is it legible in, you know, zero gravity when two people are maybe are upside down from one another? How does somebody who is, you know, mobility impaired, like, navigate in zero gravity?
That might be easier for them.
Yeah, sometimes it was, yes.
Do they have anything out that people can read on this yet, that they can see what the experiments...
They have a website, for sure.
Do you know
what it is? Mission Astro Access.
Oh, Mission Astro Access. Okay.
I don't remember the... I don't have the website address off the top of my head. But if you go to my website and click on projects, my website is Mona Minkara. MonaMinkara.com. Click on projects. You'll see all the different projects that I do. And one of them is Mission Astro Access.
Fascinating. And what do you hope that they accomplish?
That we make spacecrafts more accessible, that, you know, we start shifting our view of the fact that, you know, maybe astronauts can be individuals with disabilities, and that's okay. Not just okay, but beneficial. That's what we hope to accomplish.
This is to change that mentality. It's usually the time where I give my assistant here, Charlene, some time to maybe possibly ask some questions. So, Charlene, do you have any questions that you'd like to ask Mona?
No, I'm so blown away. I'm like stopping in the aisles and wanting to read more about what's going on. You're really fascinating, Mona. It's kind of exciting.
Thanks, Charlene.
So, is there anything else you would like to cover before we go?
No, I think this has been plenty. Thank you so much.
What would be...
It's like weird to talk about yourself for a whole hour.
What would be the one thing that you have not yet accomplished that you would like to do so?
Go to space. I don't know, make a huge scientific contribution. I don't know, climb Mount Kilimanjaro. There's a lot. So...
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming on. This has been great, and I hope we covered everything you wanted. And we want to give you a website once more if people would like to come on, find out more about you and find out about this mission that's going to go on with finding things for people with disabilities to do in space, hopefully.
Yes. So the website is monaminkara.com. That is MonaMinkara.com. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate you coming on tonight. And also thank Krissa for assisting with some of the topics. So thanks, Mona.
Thank you, Sam. Thank you, Charlene. Thank you, everybody, for listening.
Yes, take care. I want everyone to thank you for listening to the show, and we will be coming up next week. Their topic is ALS. And so hopefully you will tune in and find out more about that. If you want me to ask questions to the doctor that's going to be on, you can email me at disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com and submit those questions, and I'll be happy to ask them. Otherwise, just keep listening, and you can also join us by getting an email, and maybe you have suggestions on topics and who should be on. Thank you so much. It's been real. Take care. Stay safe. And get your vaccine. This has been Disability and Progress. The views expressed on the show are not necessarily those of KFAI or its board of directors. My name is Sam. I'm the host of this show. Thanks so much for tuning in. Charlene Dahl is my research person. And we've been speaking tonight with Dr. Mona Minkara about her story and life in science and technology and everything else. This is KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis at kfai.org. Thanks so much for listening. Good night.
www.fbi.org.